We're going to read this morning from Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. And it says, "Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. And let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God." As we come to this this opportunity that we have to look at the Word of God on New Year's Day, I know that a few of us are in different places right now. With New Year's. I know that some people here are dead tired. Some people were out late, some people were with family, some people were, maybe it wasn't just last night is the reason why you're tired. Maybe it's a whole week of kind of Christmas activities. You've baked certain or cooked certain meals, you've baked certain cookies, you've had to clean the house multiple times for different parties and things that were going on. You've gone through kind of this whole process of setting up Christmas, and you've traveled to visit family, you've had family that's come in town and that's visiting with you, and for lots of people the whole holiday season it can kind of become this overwhelming and sort of exhausting experience. And so I know that some of you here are tired, and maybe you're just kind of ready for a break now for life to get back into sort of a normal pace. And for some of you, you are probably overly well rested. For some of you, you've had the whole week off of work, and you're kind of itching to get back into your regular routine. Maybe you haven't been very, or maybe you haven't had a very stressful Christmas. Maybe it's been really relaxing for you. You had some time at home. You were just kind of with family. It was sort of a quiet holiday kind of season, and so maybe you're ready, for to get back to work. Or maybe if you're kids, you're ready for your parents to get back to work. Maybe if you're parents, you're ready for the kids to get back to school. It's kind of like you're ready to sort of start a life fresh in this next year. I imagine lots of us are in one of those two places. And the same is true for lots of people when it comes to thinking about New Year's or any kind of sort of a New Year's resolution. For people who have been stressful and kind of been in a crazy season, you probably haven't really thought much about any kind of like a New Year's resolution. It's probably sort of the last thing on your mind. And maybe you've thought about it, but maybe you think that New Year's resolutions are kind of stupid. Maybe you've had an experience where you never keep them, where it's never something that really sticks in your life. And so you're just not really into that whole kind of big ordeal of making kind of changes and thinking about the year and a fresh start and things like that. Some people are definitely in that position. And then there are other people in this room, no doubt, who love the idea of a New Year's resolution. There are people who love having the opportunity to kind of sit back and think about your life and to look at an area that you'd like to change, and then to becoming resolute, to making a promise to yourself, to making a decision with yourself that you're going to do something differently over the course of this next year. I can remember a time when Becca and I, we went to New York City between Christmas and New Year's. And so it's kind of a cool time to visit the city where everything's sort of lit up for Christmas and it's exciting and there are lots of people around. And we were just kind of doing all kinds of things. We saw a show and did some stuff like that. And then we went to Times Square because you need to walk around and go to Times Square when you're in New York City. And we saw that there's this kind of, inside one of the buildings, there was this area set up where you could write down your New Year's resolutions on a little piece of like paper, a little piece of graffiti. And then you put it in this box and then it goes, and when they drop the ball at midnight, all of those, maybe not all of those pieces of confetti, some of those pieces of confetti have these New Year's resolutions from all of these people from all over the world that stopped in New York City. And as we were there, you just see people who are kind of excited and they're writing these sort of hopeful wishes that they have for the next year and things that they really are intent on changing about themselves. And one thing is clear to me as I was looking at these people and thinking about this, it's that however you feel about New Year's resolutions, is fine, whether you love them or you hate them. But if we just take one night throughout the year to kind of step back and to think about our life and to think, maybe there are some changes I need to make. Maybe there are some ways that I could be living better. Maybe there are some, you know, whether it's healthier or any number of different changes that people make around New Year's. If we only do that once a year, we miss lots of opportunities that we have to grow and lots of opportunities that we have to be stretched and lots of chances that we have to really grow in our faith and in our relationship with God. And so this morning, as we're beginning this year, we're going to look at kind of some ways that we can evaluate our life and we can make changes in light of this passage from Hebrews chapter 12. And so as we're looking to that, there are kind of a few important background pieces about Hebrews. And there are really just a few important background pieces about Hebrews because so much of this book is kind of a mystery to us. For instance, the author of this letter is unknown. So that's kind of a rare thing for us. There are a few places where we don't really know exactly who the writer was, but for most of the New Testament, we know who wrote the letter. And so there's been lots of speculation throughout history. For a long time, people kind of assumed that Paul wrote the letter of Hebrews because he wrote so much of the New Testament. But when you look at kind of the style of the writing, when you look at the way that Paul would typically identify himself in his writing, and he doesn't do that here, it kind of leaves the book of Hebrews with this sort of mysterious feel where we're not really sure who wrote this letter. There have been people who said it was probably Apollos or Timothy, but it's all sort of speculation. There's not a sense of clarity or certainty in regards to that. And then, even kind of more strange, is that the recipients of the letter are also unknown. We don't know who the book of Hebrews was written to specifically. And there are some letters in the New Testament, when you read through, and we've talked about this, where some are written to a specific church at a specific time that's going through a specific set of circumstances. And then there are other letters that are kind of more general and broad, and they're kind of written to the churches in a general region, or they're kind of written to kind of dispel some kind of widespread problems that were going on in the church. But the book of Hebrews is unique in that when you read through the text, it looks like, it's being written to a specific church going through specific circumstances, and yet we don't know who that church is. We don't know where they're at or exactly what's going on. And so it's hard to kind of navigate the background of Hebrews. And I kind of, when I sit back and think about that, I think, well, in some ways, you know, how did this make the cut? If we don't know who wrote this letter, if we don't know who this letter was going to, how did it make the cut? How did it get in there? And there are a few things that we do know, which is why we have the book of Hebrews. And that the first is that from the very beginning, from very early on, this letter was considered authoritative in the Christian church. The earliest church fathers talk about the book of Hebrews. Clement of Rome quotes the book of Hebrews. It's something that was clearly kind of right there from the beginning, was an important thing to God's people. It's also something that's important because of what we see in Hebrews chapter 2, verse 3, which says, "This salvation, which was first announced by the Lord, was confirmed to us by those who heard him." And so when it says this salvation, it's talking about the gospel, about the message of Jesus. And what this tells us is that the people this letter was written to were in basically the same position as every letter that Paul wrote or that the other writers of the New Testament wrote, where these weren't people who immediately saw and heard Jesus, but they were saying that someone came to them who had been with Jesus, even though we don't know exactly who that was, and shared the gospel with them. So this is one of the apostles shared the gospel of Christ with these people, and this church began as a result of that. And so, as we see this and we look at the text, while we don't know a lot of things, this picture kind of begins to take shape when you read the book of Hebrews. And what you see is people who are conflicted and who are under pressure. So this is written, when it says Hebrews, this is written to people who were formerly Jews, people who were faithful Jews and then had become Christians. And we see throughout the letter that they're being pressured to go back into Judaism. So whatever area they were in, whatever city they were in, there was an active kind of Jewish population. And it says throughout the text over and over again, it stresses things about not going back to your former way of thinking. It stresses about how Jesus was the Messiah for the Jews. It stresses about how the Christian faith is the fulfillment of the Jewish law. It stresses all of these things as Christianity building upon the Jewish faith. And then on the other end of the spectrum, we see that these people are under pressure from the culture that is around them. At the time of this writing, in the letter, there are a few cues that talk about temple sacrifices that let us know that this was written before the temple was destroyed in AD 70. And so in the midst of this writing, Christians are either just about to or are currently going through some immense persecution and hardship as a result of their faith. So on one hand, these people that are being written to, they have Jews that are pressuring them to go back to the way they were thinking and the way they were living, and they have culture that's persecuting them for being Christians, and so there's a real temptation, I'm sure, by many of them to kind of drop the whole Christian thing and to go back to the way that life used to be. But this writer is encouraging them over and over again to maintain their faith in the midst of hardship. The reason for writing is to address the pressure that the people were feeling to convert back to Judaism and to abandon their faith in the midst of hardship, in the midst of a hard time. And so in light of that kind of thinking about this letter, we're going to read our passage again. In Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 and 2, it says, "Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God." And so as we think about the way that this would impact those people, there are four things that I think we pick up in this passage that help us as we evaluate our lives and look to set goals or to make changes. And the first is this, that in this passage, what we can recognize and what we can see is that life has a purpose, that our lives all have a purpose. And we see that in the analogy or the imagery that this author uses when he talks about this idea of a race that is being run for the people. You know, oftentimes when we look at this passage, when we hear this passage, when we think about it, we focus in on this idea, and this is good, and this is in there, this idea of this great cloud of witnesses that's kind of cheering us on. And so we think, you know, that as we're living life, you know, we kind of get this imagery, and it's this encouraging word that whatever we're doing, kind of wherever we're at, that there's this cloud of witnesses that is kind of pushing us and cheering us on and encouraging us in hardship. And we see that in there, but we see that very clearly in the context of a race. And there are a few things that races have, and I'm by no means an expert on racing, but there are a few things that races have that give us purpose. The first is this, that races have a set course. You know, so if you look at any kind of a track and field event, there's a set course that takes place with a race. Sometimes it's different. Sometimes you have to stay in a specific lane on the track. Sometimes you just start in a specific lane and then you can run anywhere on the track. But there's a purpose that comes with the race because you always have to stay on the track that's there. If the race, if you know, they fired the gun and the race started and everybody just kind of did whatever they wanted, there'd be no purpose to that race. If you could just kind of run in a circle and get back to the finish line without going around the track, there'd be no purpose to the race. And that's true of any kind of a race that you're in. If you are talking about a cross-country race, there's a course that you're running on that has boundaries. If you're talking about any kind of a, you know, car racing, motocross racing, anything like that, there's a track or a race that you have to stay on. And that track, those boundaries give that race a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning, because it provides kind of parameters for that. And so in this passage, what the writer is saying to the people is that you are running a race with purpose. And it says a race that has been marked out for you by God. And then that's one thing that gives a race purpose. Another thing that gives a race purpose is that there is a clear end to the race. There's a clear finish line that takes place. There's a goal in mind. There's something that you are striving towards achieving. And so for us, when we think about our lives, some of us just kind of float along in life without really a sense of direction or a sense of purpose or a sense where we're striving to achieve a certain thing. And if we do that, then we're missing opportunities that we have to live faithfully. As we think about our lives, as we think about how we can live faithfully, we should be thinking in mind of what is kind of this track that's been laid out for me, this course that has been set by God to kind of help guide and direct my steps. The second thing is this, that in any race, there's an importance on maintaining focus. And as we set goals in our life, there's certainly a clear importance on us maintaining a level of focus. And in this race, in the passage, what it says for us is that we need to have our eyes fixed on Jesus, the author or the pioneer and perfecter of our faith. And the Greek word in there that talks about having our eyes fixed on Jesus is one that's talking about having kind of a singular sort of fixed gaze. It's almost like a tunnel vision that's being described. When I think about that, it's kind of like that moment in a, you know, that moment in a movie where, or a story where the protagonist kind of sees for the first time the person that they've immediately fallen in love with. And there's kind of like everything else sort of fades out and a light comes and the birds start singing in the background. And it's sort of this beautiful kind of image where everything fades and they're fixed on one singular object of affection, object of desire. It's like the same thing that happens every time we're shopping and the boys see a dinosaur in the store. It's that kind of like you're just fixed on something. It's the same thing really, as I thought about this, if you're a pet owner and you have a dog and you're walking your dog and they see like a rabbit or a squirrel on the road ahead and all of a sudden the leash like tightens up immediately as that kind of fit, there's like a tunnel vision that guides directly towards that object of desire. That's what this means, this kind of fixed gaze that we are supposed to have, this focus that we are supposed to maintain on Jesus. He's our pursuit in this life. And in the same way that reaching a finish line in a race is a measure of success, our measure of success in this life is whether we fix our gaze on Jesus and continue to pursue him throughout the course of our lives. And this is a hard thing for us to do. Having a singular focus on anything is hard. Having a singular focus on something that you can't see on faith is a really hard thing to be able to do. My mom is a paramedic, and so when my siblings and I were learning to drive, we had lots of safety talks and lots of extra safety precautions because of things that that my mom knew. And so one of the things that I can remember hearing over and over and over again from her was that the most likely time that you have while you're driving to get into an accident is when you're driving by an accident, because you're kind of in this line of cars and everyone's driving closely together and everyone is kind of veering their heads and rubbernecking to see what took place. And so immediately kind of before you know it, then you have a pile up of cars that's lined up because people were kind of, they weren't focused on what was ahead of them. They were distracted by things that came up in life. And for all of us, for a million different reasons, we get distracted in life. Problems come up and they divert us from keeping our eyes fixed on Jesus. Issues come up in families, in homes, at work. Maybe it's not even issues or bad things that come up, but we get distracted by other pursuits and kind of side things. It's so easy in so many different ways to lose that kind of singular fixed gaze that the author of Hebrews talks about as something that's so important for us in our faith to run a race well. But if we are going to be people who are faithful in our pursuing Christ, we need to maintain our focus. And the third thing is this, that we need to look to Jesus as our example. In Hebrews chapter 12, verse 2, it says this, "For the joy set before him," which is Jesus, "he endured the cross." And in this passage, you see two words that don't really belong together. We see "for the joy that was set before him," this idea of joy, and we see "the cross." And when the people, when people were on the cross, when people were being sentenced to go to the cross, when the whole idea of the cross as a means of torture and punishment was coming about, there was no sense of joy that was ever supposed to be associated with the cross. You know, we've heard these stories lots of times, many of us have, how the cross was supposed to be this humiliating way that you could die. It was supposed to be not just being sentenced to death, but it was a public shaming reserved for kind of the worst criminals, and it was something that was agonizing, and it would drag on for days and days and days, and that in the midst of this, this agony that a person is in, there's no sense of joy that's there in that moment. And in this passage, it doesn't say that Jesus felt any joy. We don't see that in Scripture. But it says, "For the joy that was set before him, he was able to endure the cross." And for us, as we think about changes that we need to make, oftentimes this is sort of what we're coming up with to a much lesser degree. That for a future joy, for a goal to improve our lives in some sort of way, to focus in on Jesus and to be more faithful in our pursuit of him, there is some hardship that we are going to experience in life along the way. You know, there are lots of ways and lots of kind of little silly anecdotes about kind of delayed gratification or putting off something to achieve a goal or things like that that we can think about. But I think one of the most fitting ways that we can kind of imagine this is to go back again to the imagery of a race. But to think of a, you know, like a serious kind of racer, an Olympic athlete, someone who kind of beats and pushes their body to the limits and endures a level of training and hardship, and they do it all for the opportunity at the end of all of that hard work to have the joy of winning. If there's some kind of an analogy that we can draw, this might be the most fitting for us, you know, where when Jesus endures the cross, he does this for a future joy that waits beyond him. And for us, for the people who receive this letter in Hebrews, when hardship comes on either side, we need to recognize that we're enduring that for the future joy. And then the last piece is this, and this is one of the kind of the most understated pieces of this passage, that we need to maintain our ultimate hope in the work of Christ. And that's something, that's a message that we see all throughout Scripture. That we need to always be maintaining the hope that we have in the face of trial in the work of Jesus. But there's an interesting way that we see that in this passage. And it's that in this passage, it says that Jesus sits down. And when we read the passage, and it says that Jesus sits down at the right hand of God the Father, this imagery comes to mind that, you know, Jesus has ascended into heaven. He's dignified. He's kind of being ascribed this position of honor and glory. And that is all true. But a significant piece is that Jesus sits down at all, and the hope that that provides for us. Earlier in Hebrews, in chapter 10, verse 11, we see this. It says, "Day after day, every priest stands and performs his religious duties." That's important that they stand and perform their religious duties. "Again and again, he offers the same sacrifices which can never take away sins." We don't think about that lots of times when we think about the Old Testament. But what we see in the book of Hebrews is that the blood of bulls and goats was never sufficient for taking away sins. That only happened through the sacrifice of Jesus. But when we think about these priests in the Old Testament standing day after day to offer sacrifices for sins, what we don't always think about is that for us today, as people who follow Christ, when we sin, we ask Jesus for forgiveness. In the Old Testament, when you sinned, it was a blood offering that you were taking to the temple and that priests were sacrificing. So day after day after day, priests were busy people. Because as long as, you know, we have been people, we have struggled with sinning and falling away from God. And so if someone messed up and did something intentionally, they take a sacrifice to the temple. If someone messed up and did something unintentionally in a strict code of law, they take a sacrifice to the temple. If someone keeps messing up and doing the same thing over and over and over again, you go to the temple with a sacrifice over and over and over again, seeking for atonement. And with a city of people doing this and there being one temple, the priest never had a chance to sit down because people were always coming, bringing sacrifices, seeking for forgiveness of their sins. And in Hebrews chapter 10, verse 12, it says this immediately following this passage. But when this priest, referring to Jesus, had offered for all time one sacrifice for sin, he sat down at the right hand of God. This is the same thing that we read in chapter 12, verse 2. But what we see is that when we place our faith in Christ, this cycle of over and over again sinning and messing up is broken in Jesus. That we have the opportunity through his one-time sacrifice to receive forgiveness that lasts for eternity. And so in Jesus, we have a hope that surpasses any other kind of problem, any other sort of hardship that we encounter in this life. And so there are a few questions that I want us to think about as we close today. How can we fix our gaze on the pursuit of Jesus? How can we develop this kind of singular focus where everything else drowns out and we really think in our lives, in our work, in our families, in our friendships, in everything that we're doing, how are we being faithful to follow Christ? How is that our real intention in life? What are the things that you worry about or are anxious about that distract you from that? What are the problems, the real problems that you're experiencing? What are the kind of the passions, just the things that come up in life that distract you from that? And how can you focus your intent on Jesus? Also think about who are the people in our lives that we need to love like Jesus loved us? Who are the people that we need to share this sense of hope with, this kind of ultimate goal of a future that's reconciled with him? What are the things, and this is an important question for us, what are the things that distract us from having our gaze fixed on Jesus? What are the things that come up in life? And then to identify, because that might be the best goal that you can have, is to identify how to eliminate some of the things that distract you from focusing on Christ. This morning, as we take some time to pray and to worship, I would ask you to really ask yourself, what would it look like for you to focus in on Christ in this next year? What would it look like not just for, you know, you to nominally call yourself a Christian and identify as a Christian or things like that, but what would it look like for you to really fix your gaze on him? How would your life be different in that regard?